A devastating morning for emergency services that rocked a quiet suburban street. The three little children didn't stand a chance.
It's a horrific scene. It will be a horrific thing for emergency services, police, fire and ambulance to deal with in the coming days.
Hello, listeners, and welcome back to another episode of It's Crime Time. I've heard a great deal of true crime cases coming out of Australia, and I decided to look into some recent true crime stories from there. And I came across one that is very recent and absolutely vile and disgusting. And I hadn't heard of this case, so I wanted to look into it, learn more about it. And this case has been said to shed some light on how Australia actually handles domestic violence. And in this episode, I'll be detailing the 2020 murders of Hannah Clark and her three children. All right, everyone, it's crime time. Before I continue this episode, I would like to place a disclaimer here and warn you that this episode involves domestic violence and the deaths of children. If this is something that you feel that you can handle, please feel free to click off at any time. Hannah Ashley Clark was born on September 8, 1988 at the Royal Women's Hospital in Brisbane, Australia to parents Sue and Lloyd Clark and was their only daughter. Hannah had been a bright, bubbly, friendly, and hardworking woman. She was also very physically fit. She excelled at CrossFit and sports while she was in school. At the age of 16, she was the school captain in her senior year of high school and represented the state for trampoline. She then started coaching trampoline classes at the Carindale PCYC. After high school, she taught kindy gym at the PCYC and worked as a teacher in vacation care. Hannah had lived a pretty great childhood with kind and loving parents. As far as I've gathered, there was nothing off about her childhood. Her parents were very loving. She had a good upbringing, and she was still very close with her parents. Hannah met Rowan Baxter, a New Zealand-born former rugby player for the New Zealand Warriors. At this time, Hannah was around 19 or 20 years old. The court inquiry stated that she was 20, and other news sources say she was 19. But either way, 19 or 20, and Rowan was around 30 or 31 years old. So Rowan had been 11 years her senior. Rowan had been previously married and had a son who was in Hannah's kindy gym class at PCYC Carindale. Rowan had started working at this gym as a boxing instructor. At this time, Hannah was still living at home with her parents, and Rowan was living with his wife, which he claims that was only for the sake of his son and that they were separated. But apparently this was a lie, and we'll get to that later. He had met his ex-wife when he was 18, she was 16, and he had already quickly showed signs of controlling behavior and anger issues with his wife. When their son was 2 years old, she wanted to leave the relationship, I guess just because she just couldn't handle, his behavior anymore. But Rowan couldn't accept this, and he would show up to places uninvited. He would let notes on her car. He told his wife he just wanted his family back, and he had a hose pipe in the trunk of his car. He said he was planning to end things or end it for his wife, child, and himself. His wife felt she had no choice but to get back with him, and they moved from New Zealand to Australia in 2007. In 2008, Rowan met Hannah at the PCYC. Although he still lived with his wife, he started a relationship with Hannah. At this time, he finally agreed to separate from his wife and try to agree on a parenting plan for their son. On one occasion, however, he became violent with his wife and he threatened to smash her door down to get to his son. Rowan was telling Hannah that he and his wife were separated and they were only living together for their son, but this was untrue. He told one of his friends that he remained living with his wife because he couldn't afford to move, and his wife had actually known about his affair with Hannah and she was not happy about it. And I mean, I don't blame her. Think about it. She wanted to leave him to begin with, and he threatened to kill her and the kid, and himself. So she agreed to take him back, which she didn't really want to be there in the first place, but she took him back. And then he goes and, cheats on her. So I can understand why she was upset, but also this was a blessing for her because she would no longer have to deal with him. And, she wouldn't have to try to leave him again. He already met someone else and he was leaving. Blessing for her, but obviously not for Hannah and the children, as we'll find out later. So Rowan had still been living with his wife when Hannah introduced him to her parents. Hannah's mother, Sue Clark, instantly disliked Rowan. She said that she disliked him the minute she laid eyes on him. There was something about him she just couldn't stand. Eventually, he did win her parents over, however. 4 months into dating Hannah, Rowan moved in with a friend of his, and then about 6 months after they had begun dating, Hannah became pregnant to Rowan. She really wanted to have the baby, but Rowan told her she was just too young, and I'm gonna guess that, you know, he had said it obviously more than that because she aborted the baby, and she really didn't want to, so probably, you know, already starting that controlling behavior. The two then moved into a townhouse at Mansfield where Hannah worked full-time for the Athlete's Foot shops at Carindale and Capabala, terrible pronunciation, shopping centers. Rowan was working as a sales representative for a pharmaceutical company at the time. In 2011, Rowan proposed to Hannah. After 6 months of living in their townhouse, they moved to a house at Chandler and the pair were married in October of 2012. Hannah's parents paid for their wedding. At the time of the wedding, Hannah was actually pregnant again. She was 14 weeks pregnant with their daughter, Aaliyah. It's been noted that Rowan was angry at guests at the wedding for not giving the couple more money as gifts so that they could fund this overseas honeymoon, which is ridiculous. Apparently he got, you know, too many gifts that wasn't money and he was upset, which is really ridiculous. But their daughter, Aaliyah, was then born on April 10th of 2013. At this time, the pair also bought a new vehicle. It was a silver Kia Sportage. After Aaliyah had been born, Rowan then refused to pay his ex-wife any more child support for their son. And I'm not sure exactly what happened with that, but as far as I know, he refused to pay her and still didn't pay her. In the year 2013, or maybe the beginning of 2014, the pair decided to open their own gym. And they had asked Hannah's parents, Sue and Lloyd Clark, to invest in it. Her parents invested around $18,000 into this gym, and then another investor contributed $40,000 to the gym. But this gym didn't do well, and the pair had constantly been behind on their bills and their rent. And Hannah's parents often just paid the rent and the bills for Hannah and Rowan. It was said, I guess, that they would just kind of leave their unopened bills in Hannah's parents' mailbox. And the Clarks would just simply pay the bills. You know, nothing said about it. No questions. As far as I know, they just pay them. In June of 2014, Hannah became pregnant again with their second daughter, Leanna. In January of 2015, Hannah and Rowan opened another gym known as Integrate Gym at Mansfield. And then Leanna was born in March of 2015. In December of 2016, the couple's third and final child, a son named Trey, was born. 3 years after opening Integrate Gym, they decided to move it to another location in Mansfield, and at this point then, the couple bought a second car. Both cars had to be in Hannah's name due to Rowan failing to pay previous car registration bills and because he owed money to the State Penalties Enforcement Register. And this register was the register that was responsible for collecting fines and things of that sort. So I'm not exactly sure if they were fines from, you know, traffic violations, things of that nature, or if he and his ex-wife did have an agreement for child support and he owed that, so he couldn't put anything in his name at that point. In early 2017, Hannah and Rowan decided to move to Carindale. They signed a lease where they were co-tenants on this lease. At this time, their gym was struggling because Rowan had not been a good businessman. He was terrible at managing money, and he was also very blunt and rude with prospective and current gym members. He would tell a lot of the gym members that they were fat. I guess calling people fat pigs was his favorite thing to do. And when training people at the gym, he would train them until they vomited, and he kind of just laughed at it. He felt no remorse for his controlling behavior. He basically controlled everyone from what it seems like. So not only Hannah and his ex-wife, but, you know, everywhere, everyone, he liked to be in control, especially when he was training people. And I'm going to assume that obviously a lot of people stopped going to the gym because of it. You know, I'm not going to go to a gym where someone's calling me a fat pig. You know, I'm obviously in the gym for a reason. I'm trying to get fit. So, you know, that's just not a comfortable place to be. So I'm assuming that's another reason they were failing. He had also began treating Mrs. Clark, Hannah's mother, terribly, calling her names, just belittling her, yelling at her, getting into fights with her. And one time he offered to help her train. And when he did, he dropped her during the workout at their gym and he caused her to split her lip open. And when this happened, he just laughed at her and told her to harden up. So he had won the Clarks over, but by this time they were not fans of him at all again. So, I mean, I guess Mrs. Clark's initial thoughts about him, you know, not liking him the minute she saw him were correct. And she ended up not liking him again. Not only did he insult his gym clients and his mother-in-law, but he insulted his wife, Hannah, as well. He called her a fat pig. He told her she needed to lose some weight, you know, get back in shape. And if you look at pictures of Hannah, she was very, very in shape, very physically fit. She was ripped, like very muscular, beautiful woman. So his comments are just disgusting and unwarranted. And he definitely did that as a control thing, you know, just to break her down. He would not let her wear shorts or any kind of pink clothing. He told her that those were for children. Stupid, but okay. He also started punishing Hannah for misbehaving by not letting her parents watch their children or spend time with them. Because he said when Hannah messed up that the children couldn't go see their grandparents because he knew this upset Hannah. If he could keep their kids away from Hannah's parents or, of course, the kids' grandparents, that this very much upset Hannah. So he figured, okay, you know, I'm punishing Hannah's parents and her at the same time. Which is disgusting because obviously he probably didn't realize he was punishing his children as well. They want to see their grandparents. They love their grandparents. Or he did realize it, you know, and he just wanted control of them as well. So at this time, this was not the beginning of his abusive behavior. Apparently it had started way earlier on. And I'll discuss a few of those incidents here before I continue on to the main story. So at the main story right now, we're in 2017, but some of these are going to go back. At the beginning of their relationship, Hannah went on a cruise with a friend, and Rowan was obviously not happy about this because he didn't go. He contacted her constantly the whole time she was on the cruise, and shortly after they began living together, Rowan told her she couldn't wear shorts, she couldn't wear short skirts or pink, and she was allowed to wear bikinis, but only at the beach, not off the beach. He also made Hannah share a Facebook page with him because she was not allowed to have her own Facebook page. He consistently attempted to drive a wedge between Hannah and her family so that she would basically have no one else but him. And that's a lot of abusers do that. They drive a wedge between their victim and their family, their friends, and everything of that nature so that the only person that victim has to rely on is them. As I've mentioned, he would openly criticize Hannah's mother, Sue, but he even did this in front of Hannah's brother. Hannah and the children were no longer allowed to attend weekly family barbecues at her parents' house at all, apparently. And at one point, Rowan actually borrowed Hannah's brother's car and drove it for months. Now, I'm assuming this is obviously before the family had purchased, you know, their second car. He put over 18,641 miles, or about 30,000 kilometers, on Hannah's brother's car and $200 in tow bills. He never left any gas in this car either. And when Hannah's brother finally said he needed it back, Rowan stopped talking to him and made it hard for Hannah to maintain a relationship with her brother as well. Rowan would also not allow Hannah to spend Mother's Day with Sue. He allowed her to spend half of the day with her, and then she had to spend the rest of the day with Rowan celebrating his deceased mother. So that's pretty depressing that Hannah wasn't even allowed to get the entire day with her mom. She only got half of it. After Aaliyah was born, Roa would not allow Mrs. Clark to look after the baby or have the baby stay at her house. While she was pregnant with their second child, Leanna, Rowan had slammed the back gate on Hannah's leg, bruising it. After their son Trey was born in 2016, Rowan worked at the gym only 3 days a week and rested the other four. Hannah took numerous classes at the gym, took care of the children, and was doing marketing courses online, but Rowan criticized her about the house not being clean and told her she needed to get a second job, which she did at the Athlete's Foot. She worked there on Mondays and Fridays, and she worked at the gym the other days of the week. He also often went days without speaking to her, especially if she refused to have sex with him. So essentially, from what I've read, he wanted to have sex with her every day. And sometimes she refused. And when she did, he wouldn't speak to her for days at a time as a punishment. On May 18th of 2019, Hannah called her mother to tell her that Rowan had wanted sex and she didn't, which resulted in a huge fight where he smashed her watch and left the house with a hose. Hannah was afraid he went to kill himself, so her parents went looking for him. And he came home the next morning and told Hannah that he had driven to City Point Church car park and tried to kill himself. In September of 2019, Hannah wanted to have a 30th birthday dinner with family and friends, but Rowan had planned a surprise party for her at the gym. So Hannah just wanted to have her 30th birthday dinner with family and friends. She didn't want a surprise party. So Hannah's friend told Rowan that Hannah didn't want the party, and he ended up not speaking to Hannah for days, and he told her then that she couldn't celebrate her birthday at all. At this time, she wanted a necklace with the children's names engraved on it for her birthday, so Rowan collected money from members of the gym and asked Hannah's parents for money towards it. And they also ended up organizing the celebration dinner that Hannah wanted anyway, even though I guess he had told her that she wasn't allowed to celebrate regardless, but her parents did it for her anyway because obviously that's their daughter and no one's going to tell anybody that they can't celebrate their 30th birthday. In November of 2019, his controlling behavior got worse when Hannah qualified to compete in a CrossFit competition, but he failed to qualify for the solo competition. So I guess he was competing for the solo comp, or he was competing to qualify for the solo competition, but Hannah was competing to qualify for the team competition, and she got selected to compete in the team competition, but he couldn't compete in the solo, so he technically wasn't going to be there in the same competition as Hannah. Hannah asked a friend to be the third team member, and Rowan said then that he would be the fourth member, but he later dropped out due to a supposed injury, and he expected Hannah to drop out as well. But this was something she wanted to do, and she qualified for it, and she loved doing it, so she didn't drop out. On November 6, 2019, Hannah was driving back from the gym with a friend, and she had a conversation about Rowan taking over the session when Rowan somehow overheard the conversation. So Hannah was explaining to her friend that Rowan was kind of taking over this CrossFit session, or taking over the whole team, you know, things of that nature, and somehow Rowan overheard this conversation. Rowan claimed later that Aaliyah had been playing with Hannah's phone and she accidentally dialed her dad's number, Rowan's number, and he overheard the conversation. He told an associate that their kids somehow recorded the phone conversation and sent it to his phone. But the associate did not believe this, and they believed that Rowan had actually somehow been recording her. So he'd been tracking her or had a recorder in her car or on her phone or something of that nature where he could hear every phone conversation that she was engaged in. The first day of the CrossFit competition was on November 8th. Rowan made Hannah take a gym class that morning, and when she came home from the gym at 7, she found the children and Rowan gone from the home and feared he was going to do something to them. So she called her mom crying and was vomiting due to just the sheer terror of, you know, what he's going to do to my kids. He had his phone turned off, and later he sent her a text message saying he couldn't believe she was competing without him. He came home later that day and said he had just taken the children to the beach. When he had left the home, he had this old phone recording Hannah's conversations with her mom. He claimed they had called him derogatory names during the conversations, which, I mean, even if they did, I mean, think about it, you know, he was treating her like shit. He ran off with the kids and she had no idea where her, you know, her kids were. And so, yeah, if she was pissed off and calling him names, I mean, I understand. He talked to an associate about this whole thing and he claimed that he accidentally left this old phone recording by mistake at the house, but it was believed that he had a listening device in the home and in her car. Hannah told Aaliyah that she would take her to watch the finals of the CrossFit competition, but Rowan wouldn't allow them to go. They got into an argument and Hannah left, insisting she was taking Aaliyah to watch the competition, when Rowan grabbed her by the arm, leaving red marks on her arm, which her friend noticed. Hannah said there would be no more discussions, and once that weekend was over, she would be leaving him because she just couldn't take it anymore, and that was the final straw. That was the last time, you know, that he touched her or treated her like shit. The next week, Hannah told her friend that she had just been keeping her head down at home and explained to her mom that Rowan had been checking her phone in the middle of the night while she was sleeping. She woke up one night and asked him what he was doing. He got mad and threw her phone and broke the screen of it. She began to think he was tracking her phone and listening in on her calls because he questioned her on why she called certain people, and she knew the details of their conversation. So, I mean, this is a little fishy. Rowan became suspicious that Hannah may have been having a relationship with this guy who was also on that CrossFit team, and they referred to him as Mr. D. because Rowan caught her speaking to him on the phone one night and he went ballistic. He accused her of having an affair with this guy, and Hannah began preparing to leave and told her mother that she wanted to return home with the children because, you know, she wasn't having an affair. But I mean, there's nothing that she could say or do to make him believe otherwise. So she was tired of it and she prepared to leave. On December 5th, 2019, Hannah's best friend, Nicole, called Mrs. Clark and told her that Hannah had moved out. They had taken Aaliyah out of school and Hannah had only taken a few things out of the home and that she was scared. Nicole said they had hid Hannah's car and left her phone in it at the time, just in case Rowan did have a tracking device. The next day, Hannah and the children moved back in with their parents. Rowan called Hannah that day multiple times, telling her that she was hurting the children by leaving him. And I'm not sure how the children felt about their father. I mean, obviously he was their father, but there were some things that he had done to his children that just were not okay, in my opinion. So I'm not sure. I think they may have been, you know, afraid of him too. And I'm sure they witnessed, you know, him fighting with their mom, of course. But one time, while Rowan was playing with Aaliyah, he knocked her into a door frame so hard that it split her head open. He also made the children participate in post-workout ice baths with him. Trey was screaming and his eyes were bulging with fear as he was nearly submerged in the freezing water. And Rowan would film some of these experiences of his children and post it to the gym's Facebook page, thinking, I guess, it was funny, it would get them more business or something. But that's very odd. And like, you could tell that that their son Trey was terrified, I guess, on the video. And I mean, that's like actively recording him essentially abusing the child. So I don't know why I thought that was a good idea to post it on Facebook. But anyway, Aaliyah, their oldest daughter, was terrified of her father. But she did stand up to him often. When Rowan would storm out of the home during fights, Aaliyah would slam the door behind him and yell, "And don't come back." If Rowan was refusing to speak to Hannah, Aaliyah would say to him, "Daddy, Mommy said sorry. Can't you talk to her?" He disliked Aaliyah out of his three children the most because she was strong and she would stand up for herself, her siblings, and their mom. After Hannah and the three children had moved back in with their parents, Hannah wanted to speak to the police about getting some sort of no contact order or a domestic violence order because she was terrified of him and he would not stop contacting her about coming back. On December 6, 2019, Hannah went to the Corina police station and met with Senior Constable Kirsten Kent, who explained to her that she can obtain a DVO, but she feared that would only aggravate Rowan. So a DVO is, as far as I know, a domestic violence order, which is similar to, I guess, a protective order or protection from abuse order. But she didn't get it at this time because she was afraid it would aggravate him, it would make him worse. And I don't think he's going to care about, you know, some piece of paper. Essentially, a lot of these abusers don't. They don't care. That makes them angrier. When Hannah obtained a new phone, Rowan still continued to contact her on this old phone, and he wanted to pick her up and take her out. The two did go out, and when they returned to the Clark's home, Rowan was crying and asking for help. He stayed for dinner at their home, and then Hannah went to stay with him at their old home. She did tell her mom that she would be at the 5 a.m. gym class the next morning, though. The next morning, Mrs. Clark attended the gym class, and so did Rowan, but Hannah did not. She was not there. She did get in contact with her mother to tell her that she was actually at her brother's house with all of the children. Her brother then contacted Mrs. Clark to tell her that Rowan had been calling Hannah and telling her she needed to come home because she was hurting the children. So even when she was staying with her brother for that day there, however long, Rowan was still contacting her. On December 8th, Constable Kirsten Kent ran into Hannah in the shopping center and gave her info about her DVO case and contacted the Vulnerable Persons Unit of the QPS to discuss Hannah's case. A couple of days later, Hannah officially moved in with her parents along with the children. So this was official. I guess this time she took all of her things and everything of that nature and decided, this is it. I'm done. I am staying with my parents. She took the children to visit Rowan a few days later, and he asked Hannah to come in and see what he was cooking. And when she did, he took the children and began putting them to sleep in his bedroom. When Mrs. Clark texted Hannah after becoming worried at 8:30 p.m., Hannah asked her mother to come to the home straight away because she wanted to take her children home, but Rowan had been refusing to let her take the kids. So Hannah's mom kind of, I guess, was wondering, well, what's taking so long? And she became worried, and then Hannah said, you know, Mom, you need to get over here. He won't give me the kids back. Rowan told the Clarks that Hannah was crazy and she was making things up, and he started crying when they still wanted to take the children. So eventually they left the children with Rowan. But they were terrified, that he might do something to harm the children, because, you know, what's the best way to get back at Hannah is to do something to her kids. So they left the children with him, and he did bring the children home the next morning, and he told Hannah he had this mental health assessment done and that she needed to come home with the children, and he just couldn't understand why she wouldn't. Soon after Hannah had moved into her parents' home, Rowan showed up, and he walked into the home and was standing outside Hannah's bedroom door listening to her talk to the children. Hannah noticed that he was out there, and she saw that he had a phone in his hand. He asked her whose phone this was, and at first she said, oh, it's my mom's phone. But then she did tell him, okay, it's my new phone because you're tracking my other one. On December 21st, Rowan had the children for a few days, and he was supposed to take them home at 4 p.m. He agreed to do this because the Clarks had hired a van to take Hannah and the kids to visit Mr. Clark's mom in Kingaroo the next day. But Rowan texted Hannah at 4:30 p.m. saying he was running late. Then she called him at 5:30 p.m. and he claimed he was stuck in traffic. An hour later, though, he called Hannah and said, yeah, actually, you know, I might keep the children for a few more days. Hannah begged him to bring them back, and her dad drove to Rowan's house and saw him driving down the street, where he followed him and saw Rowan park in a car park. Hannah told her dad, just come home, because she didn't want Rowan to know that he was following him. Rowan had talked to his friend at 4:30 p.m. saying he was supposed to bring the children back, but he was going to keep them. Then at 8:30 p.m., Rowan called Hannah and told her she can collect the children from a service station at Cleveland if she came alone. She got the children alone, and Aaliyah had been very upset at this time because she knew that she was supposed to be home hours earlier and their dad wouldn't take her home. On December 22nd, Rowan contacted, I think it's called Centrelink, to apply for full parenting payments, telling them that he had full custody of the children. But Centrelink contacted Hannah to see if this was true, and they found out that Hannah was actually the primary caregiver for the children. So I'm guessing they obviously didn't give Rowan payments for the children. And then Rowan showed up to the Clark's home on December 24th to see his children for Christmas. But at this point, he only stayed 15 minutes, and he brought them these gift cards, but they had no funds on them, which was actually discovered later when the Clarks, I guess, took the kids out and tried to get toys for them with these cards, and there was no money on them. On December 26th, Rowan wanted to take the children to the skate park to play with their new skateboards that they got for Christmas. Hannah allowed this, but then she refused because Rowan said he was taking the children home with him. So at this time, he snatched Liana, threw her in the front seat of his car, unrestrained, and he drove away after telling Hannah that this was her fault and she caused all of it. Rowan kept Liana for 3 days in New South Wales at a friend's house. This friend even texted Hannah saying that this was all her fault and she just couldn't keep the children from Rowan. On December 26th, the day that he had taken Liana, a female flagged down two constables, Luke Erba and Shane Cobbin, at 10:30 a.m. to tell them that she spotted a man and woman arguing, and then she saw the man take the child and put her in his car and drive away. This was the incident, like I said, where Rowan took Liana, and they then were flagged down by Hannah herself further down the street. She explained what happened with Rowan. She said he had threatened her by saying that if she did not allow him to take all three of the children, he would not be bringing Liana back to her. She also explained that she had been in contact with Kirsten Kent about the DVO and why she had not obtained one. Calvin and Erba told Hannah they could not go and take Liana back because there was no court order, but they could ask Rowan to give her back. Rowan also told Hannah that she needed to fix her affair she was supposedly having with this Mr. D guy before she would ever get Liana back. The next day, Rowan received a letter from Hannah's lawyers urging him to give Liana back at once. Hannah contacted the property manager and told the manager that she wanted her name taken off of the lease for the home that she and Rowan rented. But this manager asked Rowan if he had consented to this, and he did not. So that's kind of dumb. The property manager wouldn't allow Hannah to take her own name off of lease. Kirsten Kent also told Hannah she was applying for the DVO on her behalf. Hannah did consent finally and provide an affidavit or a statement about this. The same day, Rowan stated that Hannah had taken his dog, but did not tell her to bring it back because he was afraid she would make a scene in front of his daughter. dumb. Police agreed that Rowan had placed Liana in some, I guess, some form of danger, and they granted a PPN with conditions that Rowan could not be within 100 meters of his children or Hannah's residence until these matters were taken to court, until they were resolved in court. On December 28th, Rowan sent a proposal out to K Lawyers, which is Hannah's lawyer group, demanding 50-50 time with the children, like I said, and it involved Hannah picking the children up and dropping them off at every changeover. At this time, a friend had given Rowan $2,000 to pay for counseling because he believed that Rowan was going to hurt himself. That night, Rowan sent a text saying Leanna was tired and going to bed early. Hannah called the police and told them that Rowan was at home. Police attended his house, but he wasn't there. Hannah went over and opened the house as there were lights and a TV on inside. She saw that Rowan had put up photos of her that weren't there before, so it's kind of creepy. He kind of built this weird shrine, I guess, of her in the home that they used to share. At about 7 a.m. on December 29th, Constable Justin Kersey and Sergeant Nigel Johns attended Rowan's residence to serve him with the PPN, or Police Protection Notice, and a DVO application. When they arrived, Rowan was putting Liana into the car to go out. They went back inside the house, and he was served with the PPN and the application. Constable Kersey told Rowan that he was there to serve him the PPN and the application, and Rowan commenced to complain immediately and repeatedly said it was not fair. He was read the conditions and said that he understood them. He agreed with the conditions until it came to Liana, and then he started to disagree with it and said that Hannah couldn't do that to him. Sergeant Johns explained that it was the police that had obtained the order, not Hannah. Because the DVO, if you remember, Hannah would not really go after it or try to get it in the beginning because she was afraid of what Rowan would do. So the constables decided, well, we're gonna get it on your behalf. We're going to do it for you. He became upset that he couldn't go within 100 meters of his children and said again that it wasn't fair. He tried to make a phone call, but apparently he couldn't make a phone call because he had started crying too bad. During the time the police were in the house, he would not let go of Liana. He carried her, and then he sat her on his lap with his arms around her. Rowan said that he rang the police the night before because he had been away at a friend's house for 3 days, and he thought Hannah was going to come around and take Liana. He gave a false version about taking Liana in the car and said that she wanted to go with him. He said he had done nothing wrong and only wanted to look after his children. He said his friends gave him some advice. When he got home, he said the dog was gone and Hannah had taken all of his alcohol. He was worried she was going to come over and make a scene, which, no. He said he hadn't done anything to warrant any of this. Hannah's solicitor asked him to bring Liana back. When he refused, they said they were going to court. She'd been pushed to the wall, so she'd brought this application. The police repeated that it was not Hannah's application. It was a police application. On January 4th of 2020, Hannah, the children, and her parents were at Carindale Shopping Center when Mr. Clark received a phone call from a friend of Rowan's who asked him why Hannah was not allowing Rowan to see the children. On January 8th, Rowan went to court and advised the court that the DVO application was contested. Two barristers and somebody named Mr. E accompanied him to court. He had not retained these lawyers. They were actually friends of friends that he had persuaded to help him. The parenting plan was negotiated and the matter was adjourned to February 5th of 2020. The court made a temporary protection order in which Rowan was ordered not to commit acts of domestic violence, expose the children to domestic violence, go within 100 meters of Hannah's residence, and contact Hannah unless to contact the children or arrange contact with the children. On January 14th, Rowan sent an email to K Lawyers advising it had been 24 hours since he saw his children. His tone was patronizing, aggressive, and bullying. On January 19th, a solicitor known as Mr. C commenced acting for Rowan. He acted pro bono because Rowan was friends with his brother, and Rowan said he was struggling financially. On January 20th, Hannah applied to vary the TPO to obtain stricter conditions. So she wanted to verify this temporary protection order to be a little stricter. On January 21st, Mr. C emailed K Lawyers stating that Rowan had not seen his children for a month and wanted them dropped off at his residence at 8 a.m. on January 24th, and he would return them on the 26th. of January at 4 p.m. On January 21st, Rowan Baxter texted Mr. M asking him to tell his lawyer that Hannah said she was only taking out the DVO to get Layana back, which that's not the case. She was genuinely afraid of Rowan Baxter. She wasn't just trying to get her kid back. She wanted, you know, to get away from him. She wanted him away from her too. On January 22nd, 2020, an internal email was sent at C Lawyers indicating that Rowan instructed that he did not see the children on Christmas Day. On January 22nd, Mr. C emailed the police prosecutor advising that the domestic violence order was strongly contested. Rowan would call two witnesses who would say that Hannah only brought the application for custody matters, and another witness would say that Hannah told him she was only doing it to get the kids back. So, a little odd that even Rowan's lawyers are, like, I don't know, saying things of this nature. If this is proven, that they would seek costs for Rowan, so I guess they would help him obtain some kind of monetary, I don't know, not necessarily reward, but a payback for what he had been through. I'm not sure. I guess that's what that means. On January 22nd, Mr. C represented Rowan in court in relation to the application to vary the TPO. The court made the variation as sought by Hannah. On January 23rd, the mediator sent an interim parenting plan to Mr. C, pending court determination, with the following terms. The children will live with their mother. They spend every second weekend with Rowan. They spend every other week, Thursday to Friday, with Rowan. Holidays are shared. They will FaceTime Rowan Tuesday and Thursday at 6 p.m. Changeovers take place at the Clark's house. On January 29th, Rowan drafted a letter to Hannah signed from himself and the three children, which seemed to be written in contemplation of his death, or Hannah's. On the morning of January 30th, Aaliyah was crying because she didn't want to go to her father's place that night. Hannah told, I guess it was another mom at the school, that Rowan had picked up Trey and turned his phone off. The mother told her that she saw the girls that afternoon at school and they were not their usually happy selves. Hannah texted her that Rowan was horrible to Aaliyah because she stood up to him. Rowan had the children overnight, and Hannah received a FaceTime call from Aaliyah that night. She was crying and said that Rowan was driving them on a highway and she didn't know where they were and where they were going to go. When Aaliyah arrived at school on January 31st, she asked one of the moms if she could use her phone to call Hannah. That same day, Rowan returned Trey after 9 a.m., contrary to the agreement. Hannah saw explicit photos of her in Rowan's car and grabbed them. And I guess he walked away, or she walked away taking these photos. And Rowan got out of the car and followed her and grabbed her wrist. Mrs. Clark heard Hannah scream and she phoned the police. Hannah was advised by her solicitor not to continue contact and to allow phone contact only between Rowan and the children until the family court proceedings. Hannah reported the breach to Senior Constable Kirsten Kent, and Kent disclosed to her that she had become friendly with Hannah. He took over as the lead officer. So I'm guessing that the senior constable, Kirsten Kent, had become very close with Hannah. And I guess maybe she didn't feel comfortable being in this case anymore. So she told her sergeant that she had become friendly with Hannah, and he kind of took over as the lead officer on her case then. On January 31st, Rowan emailed Mr. C advising of the photo incident. So he had inappropriate photos of Hannah in his car and she went in and got them because that's gross and she didn't want him to have those. And he grabbed her wrist. On February 1st, Hannah attended a GP who diagnosed her with a sprained wrist, which required a splint. So apparently he had grabbed her hard enough to sprain her wrist, which is ridiculous. On February 2nd, Senior Constable Kent and Sergeant Rolfe attended Rowan's house and spoke to him about the assault and breach of the TPO that happened on January 31st. Rowan said he had been told by his lawyer not to speak to the police, and he didn't wish to participate in an interview without a solicitor. He said he had already been to Corporu Police Station as he went there as soon as the incident occurred, and he told them, what happened. On February 9th, Sergeant Johns and Constable Kersey saw Rowan at Carindale Shopping Center. They were aware that he was wanted for questioning in relation to the breach of this DVO. They approached him, and Constable Kersey activated his body camera, just obviously to record what had happened with this conversation that they were, you know, about to talk to him about breaching this order. Rowan went to the Carindale police with the officers, and he declined to participate in a record of interview on advice from his solicitor, Mr. C. After speaking to him on the phone, Rowan asked Mr. C why it was going this far. Constable Kersey told Mr. C he would have to charge Rowan and he would have to go through the watch house as it was a DV matter. So they have this place called the watch house and they have to go through the watch house for domestic violence matters. Constable Kersey asked Sergeant Johns whether they could serve Rowan with a notice to appear. Constable Kersey read the allegations of the incident on January 31st, where Hannah had found the photos in the car. He grabbed her on the arm, and he said they were deciding on whether Rowan could be given an NTA or whether they would have to take him through the watch house. Constable Kersey left to make a phone call and return and told Rowan he was taking him to the watch house. He then issued him the NTA in the Brisbane Magistrates Court on March 2nd of 2020 and told him he was then free to leave. Later that day, Constable Kersey phoned Hannah and advised her that Rowan had been charged with the breach on January 31st. Mr. C sent a letter to K lawyers requesting reinstatement of the parenting plan and advising Rowan was availing himself of the appropriate courses in counseling. So basically, Rowan had his lawyers say, hey, he's taking counseling. Everything's fine. He's doing good now. He needs to see his kids again, blah, blah, blah. So I guess at that point, he was seen at 5:40 p.m. He was recorded on some CCTV entering the Bunnings Hardware Store on the corner of Creek and Wecker Roads, Mount Gravatt. And when he was in this store, he was browsing all of the aisles, and he initially had selected some lawnmower fuel. But then he replaced it and he just purchased a green jerry can that held fuel, zip ties, and a bottle of methylated spirits. He arrived home at 6:12 p.m. that night, and he took the jerry can and the cable ties from his boot into his garage. So this says boot, which is obviously the trunk of his car. And then that day, Rowan had went to his aunt's residence and he told her he needed to borrow her car, which was a Nissan, for a couple of days because he had to travel to the Gold Coast, and he said his car used too much gas. On February 18th, he left his home in the Nissan at 6:40 a.m. At 7:27 a.m., he then went to the Caltech service station at Carindale, and he purchased 4.6 liters of fuel, which he put into the jerry can. He also purchased 3 Kinder Surprise chocolates and 2 bags of lollipops. He returned home at 7:35 a.m. and parked on the street and entered his house. At 7:51 a.m., he left the house and drove off in the direction of Westfield, Carindale. At 7:51, he drove by the Clarks on Durhamville Street at Camp Hill. At 8:24, Hannah left her parents' residence in her Kia Sportage. At 8:43 a.m., Baxter returned to his house, jogged from his car into the house, and rushed back to the vehicle a short time later. At 3:28, Rowan went home. He phoned Youth and Family Services and inquired about some men's support program they had. At 4 p.m., Rowan phoned Men's Line inquiring about the 10-week men's program. At 7:23 p.m., Rowan's aunt sent him a text message asking if she could have her car back. He replied that he just required it one more day, I guess, which was he just required it tomorrow, so the next day. At 9:20 a.m. on February 18th, Rowan transferred $920 to the property manager, and this was to bring his rent arrears up to date. He had been behind on rent. Hannah went to court to have her name removed from the rental property lease then. Rowan called another friend and told him he had lost everything. He lost Hannah, the kids, he had no money and no way out, and he had been served with an eviction notice. Rowan FaceTimed the children that night, but he didn't even speak to them. He just cried. Hannah told them they could hang up if he wasn't speaking to them. She told her mother and said, oh God, what if he kills himself? At 6:30 a.m., Hannah went out to get coffee for herself and her mother the next day, and then she returned home. She sat on her mom's bed, drinking her coffee while her mother got ready for work. And the two girls were playing in their bedroom, and Trey was watching a dinosaur show on TV. At 6:48 a.m., Rowan left his house in the Nissan. At 6:54, he stopped at a service station, and he put some gas in his vehicle. Then at 7 a.m., he went to Piccolo Coffee Co. Cafe on Samuel Street in Camp Hill. He ordered a takeaway coffee. He told the barista he was fighting with the ex-missus. He took his coffee and sat at a table on the footpath, stayed there for about an hour. The barista noticed he was on his phone and seemed to be looking at the maps application. At about 7:20 a.m., Mrs. Clark kissed her daughter and Grant and children goodbye and told Hannah she loved her for the last time, and she left for work. At 8:02 a.m., Rowan was driving on Durhamville Street. At 8:12 a.m., he stopped outside a house near the Clark's residence. At 8:17, he drove back to the Clark's residence and parked across the road. Hannah was leaving home in her silver Kia. She was driving the car, and the three children were in the back seat. Trey was in the middle in a car seat. Aaliyah was behind the driver's seat, and Leanna was sitting in a booster seat behind the passenger's seat. As Hannah started the car, Rowan jumped in the passenger seat and told her to drive. He was holding a gas container, so I guess it was that jerry can that he had purchased. Hannah screamed at him to get out of the car, but he wouldn't. At about 8:25 a.m., Michael Zemek was in the driveway of his house in Raven Street at Camp Hill washing his car. Hannah pulled over in front of Mr. Zemek and screamed to him, call the police, he's going to kill me. He's poured petrol on me. Mr. Zemek saw Rowan in the front seat. He was actually physically restraining Hannah from getting out of the car. He was kind of holding her around the arms and the chest, kind of like a big bear hug with both of his hands, and she was trying to break free from him and she couldn't. Mr. Zemek noted he didn't seem crazy, but he definitely seemed like he was in control. Almost immediately, the car erupted into flames. Mr. Zemek ran to the vehicle. He can't remember whether he or Hannah opened the car door, but she jumped out of the car. And Mr. Zemek had actually sustained some burns from this incident to his face from the fire. He couldn't return to the vehicle because the fire was just too hot at the time. Hannah was alight at this point, so when she got out of the car, she had already burst into flames. She was on fire. Mr. Zemek told her to get on the ground and roll while he hosed her off. When the flames were extinguished, he went to the other side of the car where he saw Rowan lying on the road. Rowan was also on fire, so Mr. Zemek hosed him off. As Mr. Zemek returned to Hannah, she was screaming something about her children being in the car. But he said he couldn't really make sense of what she was saying because she was so burnt. Mr. Zemek ran to his house to ask his daughter to call. And in their country, it's not 911, it's 000. The first call to 000 was received at 8:26 a.m. Mr. Zemek changed his hose from the tank water to the main water, where he returned to the footpath and he continued to assist. Then later, Mr. Zemek had to be taken to the hospital and admitted to the burns unit because he had burns to his face, his eye, and his arm. And these are the burns he sustained getting Hannah out of the car. Another woman, Samantha Covey, was driving her children to swimming classes that morning. And when she drove along City View Road at Camp Hill, she saw smoke coming from Raven Street. She turned onto that street and she saw the car on fire. She got out of her car and went to Hannah, who was lying in the grass. Miss Covey picked up the hose that Mr. Zemek had been using and started hosing Hannah's body. Hannah said she couldn't believe what Rowan had done. She said she had a DVO. She said her babies were in the car and she asked whether anyone had got them out. Hannah told Miss Covey that she saw a man washing his car, so she stopped so that he could call the police, and Rowan dropped the lighter. She said she had tried to stop him and she had ripped his shirt in the process. Carrie Fernandez, who lives on Raven Street, heard a woman screaming, call the police. She then heard this bone-chilling scream, and that's when she went outside and she saw a car drive up on the curb on Raven Street, and that's when she immediately had dialed 000. As she was on the phone, the car had exploded. She walked towards the car and saw that other people were on the phone, so she hung up her phone and ran back to her house to get a fire extinguisher from her garage. And when she did, she saw Rowan standing on the footpath. He was burnt. So she got the extinguisher. She ran to the car where, you know, with it where everything was going on, and she attempted to extinguish the flames that were kind of still raging from the car. The vehicle started to roll backwards and people were yelling to watch out in case it exploded. Hannah had stood up at this point and yelled, "My kids." And there was another man on the street on this day. His name was Benjamin Young. He was installing signs on the street that morning. He parked about 15 meters from where Mr. Zemek was standing, and he heard Hannah screaming and turned around and saw her pull up in the car. He heard her say, "He's doused me with petrol. Call the police." And what he had stated about this incident was, quote, "At that point, it sounded like a bomb went off. It was so loud, I felt the shock waves. The car was engulfed in flames almost instantly. The car exploded about 10 meters from where I was," end quote. Mr. Young saw Mr. Zemek run up the driveway to turn his hose on, and he was screaming at Hannah to get away from the car. Mr. Young ran towards the car, and he saw two men running to it from the opposite side of the road. They went to the passenger side, and Rowan got out of the car. They grabbed him and moved him to the curb. The car started to roll backwards, and Rowan drove, or he dove into the front passenger seat head first, and then came straight back out. Mr. Young obtained two pieces of timber from the back of his, I guess it was a UTE vehicle, and he gave them to the two men who went to the back of the car to try to stop it from rolling. So they were using these boards to kind of stop this vehicle from rolling backward anymore. He heard one of them yell, "Get them out, get them out." He ran back to the car and saw a baby seat in the back seat of the burning car. The three couldn't get close to the car to get the babies out or to get her kids out because the car was just engulfed and it was burning very violently at this point. Carrie Fernandez continued to use the extinguisher on the car. She saw Rowan walking around the car aggressively. He was very badly burned. Carrie Fernandez was also getting burnt from the heat of the car, so she went around to the passenger side, and that's when Rowan had dove back into the car head first and came out again. Not exactly sure why he did that. Reese Gourley was watching Rowan and saw that he had retrieved a knife from his car, or from the car. So I guess that's why he dove back into the car quick, was to get this knife he had with him. He warned Carrie Fernandez that Rowan had been armed, and Rowan then kind of put the tip of his knife to his stomach or like his chest area, and he pushed himself onto it. And then after this occurred, he fell onto his side and he curled up in a fetal position. Fire and emergency service officers were the first people on the scene, besides, of course, the neighbors and everyone there trying to help. They were the first emergency personnel on the scene. QFES crews then came to extinguish the fire. Miss Covey continued to host Hannah as she spoke to the first responding police officers. Hannah told first responders that her three children were still in the car. Senior Constable Angus Skeens, one of the first responders, tried to obtain some information from Hannah. I mean, she was in very rough shape. She was severely burnt, but the constable wanted to see if, you know, there could be any information he could get from her. She told him that she and the children got in the car to go to school at her parents' place. And then she said she had turned the car on, and that's when Rowan jumped in the front seat. She started to scream. He told her to drive. He said all he wanted to do was see his children. She told him to get out of the vehicle, and he kept telling her to drive. And then that's whenever he pulled out his jerry can, and she saw this man washing his car. So she pulled over and asked him to call the police because Rowan had poured this petrol or this gas everywhere, all over the car, I guess the inside of the car, all over her, the children. And then he lit the car. There was an advanced care paramedic there. His name was DeRage Bichel. I highly apologize for that name, pronunciation. And then there was another one, Barry Twomey. And they attended the scene and they saw QFES hosing down an actual guy with a hose and applying pressure to his chest. And that was, that would have been Rowan. They saw that this guy was burnt. He was unresponsive. And his partner, that would be Barry Twomey, told him that there was also a female who needed assistance and there was deceased children in the car. Officer Bichel saw that QFES were still trying to extinguish the car when he walked up the footpath and saw Hannah standing on this nature strip. She was still being hosed down by Miss Covey. Hannah was able to introduce herself. He saw that she had full thickness burns to more than 80% of her body. She was lucid at this point, but she was obviously in pain. She was in a lot of pain, but she was still able to communicate. So he gave her some oxygen through a mask, and he tried to find a vein in her inner elbow, and then he tried in her hand, but he was unsuccessful. So he asked the police officer to bring a stretcher from the ambulance, and he administered her some morphine. And he gave her some morphine. I guess it was intramuscularly, like into her thigh, because they couldn't get a vein for her IV. And while he was treating her, Hannah stated, "I hope he survives and rots in jail for the rest of his life," end quote. So that's what she had said about Rowan. She asked Officer Pichelle if her children were okay. He told her it was important to concentrate on herself right now. The stretcher arrived and he assisted her onto the stretcher. Madison Freer, an ambulance officer, and her partner Robin Carter arrived at the scene at about 8:41 a.m. They were advised by their senior operations supervisor to attend to the female patient. They continued to try to get IV access. And then the doctor, Dr. Rashford, who is the medical director of QAS and an emergency medical specialist, arrived there. And he saw immediately that Hannah had suffered these full thickness burns to her entire body, which they were non-survivable burns. He instructed the crew to give Hannah 50 micrograms of fentanyl via IV, which had just been established via her hands. So they did finally get the IV in her. I guess they got it somewhere in a vein in her hand. And she was still talking and everything at that point. But when he got there, when Dr. Rashford got there, he did notice that she had suffered these full thickness burns. And he said they were non-survivable, that she wouldn't survive. He told them to put Hannah into the ambulance for rapid sequence induction, which is RSI, to occur. That's where they put anesthetic in her to make her sleep. Because, I mean, she was in so much pain, and they often kind of put you to sleep so that your body is not in distress at the moment. Because at this time, Hannah was speaking that she could really only talk at this point when she was prompted to do so. Officer Pichelle asked Hannah how she was doing, and she replied, "I am in pain." He told her they'd give her something for the pain. Some other paramedics arrived at this point. I think they call it HARU, the High Acuity Response Unit, and a critical care paramedic. They took over the care of Hannah, and then the children at this point were pronounced deceased at the scene at 9:53 a.m. They had sustained injuries that were clearly incompatible with life. They had been burnt so badly that they could not be visually identified, sadly. And then, of course, despite extreme efforts to save him, Rowan Baxter was pronounced deceased at the scene. He had been hosed off and administered first aid. He tried to speak, but he was unable to form any words. He still had the knife in his chest. Paramedics removed the knife, and they performed these finger thoracostomies on each side of his chest. There's a clamshell thoracotomy that was performed, which this kind of revealed blood under pressure. And I'm guessing this was in the sac around his heart. I'm guessing that's what they're describing in this part. So the pericardium was opened, the blood had been evacuated, and the wound to the heart was closed with staples. Internal cardiac massage was even performed, which, by the way, I've always thought that was so cool to watch, how they massage your heart with their hands to try to get it beating again. But this was all unsuccessful, and Rowan Baxter was pronounced deceased at 9:14 a.m. And then, of course, the sad part, I mean, obviously this, it's sad about the kids as well, but Hannah did pass away later that day at 5:40 p.m. that evening in the Royal Brisbane and Queen's Hospital. So she did not survive her injuries, but it's just insane to me that she was able to talk and explain everything and explain her her story, you know, before passing away. There was an autopsy carried out on Hannah, and it revealed that she died from multiple organ failure from the effects of the fire. Aaliyah died from the effects of the fire, including smoke inhalation and burns. She had severe burns to 100% of her body. Whilst toxicology was positive for a potentially toxic blood level of carbon monoxide, this is unlikely to have caused her death. Leanna died from the effects of a fire, including direct thermal effects, the effects of inhalation of smoke, and other products of combustion. Trey died from the effects of fire, including direct thermal effects, the effects of inhalation of smoke, and other products of combustion. Rowan's autopsy revealed that he died from a stab wound to the chest. At the time of death, he was also suffering from burns, and they were very extensive as well. They involved 80% of his body. They may also have contributed to his death. Toxicology was negative for drugs and alcohol. He had superficial sharp force injuries, which were consistent with self-infliction. He had 3 stab wounds. One had entered the abdominal wall only. One had entered the abdominal cavity and very superficially involved the stomach. And then one near the midline had passed upward into the chest cavity and was responsible for the injury to his heart that had caused his death. And there was a lot of this information I've gathered was from this, but there was an inquest into the deaths and the events that were leading up to them. And it was started on Monday, March 22nd, 2022, and ended on March 31st, 2022. This inquest would help Hannah's parents and other family members and her friends to kind of understand what happened and what happened leading up to this. What went wrong? You know, why did nothing happen to Rowan to keep him from harming, you know, his wife and children, ultimately killing them? But her family just wanted to try to understand everything and try to understand how we got to this point. 35 witnesses gave evidence testimony, and many more written witness statements were introduced at this inquest. During the inquest, as I mentioned, there was a lot of witnesses, and one discussed this chilling note that was found on Rowan's phone after his death. And it kind of revealed his reasoning for killing Hannah. And I guess he had never sent this to Hannah. He typed it up, but he had never sent it to her. And it states, quote, "I'm finishing your game. I don't want to play it anymore. You can't fuck with someone's life like this and expect them to take it. I've told the kids that you love them. They will miss you, I'm sure," end quote. So at first it sounds like he had just planned on killing Hannah. But maybe later he realized that obviously if he kills their mother, he will be in prison. He won't get custody of his children. He won't get his kids back like he wanted if he did this to her. And I think he just took the opportunity that he felt he had at the time. And the children happened to be there. And that's when he just decided to kill everyone, including himself. Because he claimed she was playing a game because she didn't want to be with him, which, I mean, I don't blame her. Obviously, he was an abuser. She needed to get away from him. And of course, the children, he, I guess, felt that, you know, she was using the kids against him, which is not the case at all. She was just trying to keep herself and the children safe. She tried the parenting plan thing. He wasn't taking it seriously. He wasn't just complying with it. And, you know, when you don't listen to the rules or the laws, you don't get good things. Good things don't happen to you. So when he didn't comply, you know, I don't know what he expected. Good things were going to happen to them when he snatched his daughter and took her for 3 days. So yeah, he just didn't understand that that's not how things work. You know, you act up like that, you do bad things, your good things will not come to you in return. Hannah's mother, Sue Clark, also said when she was given evidence, quote, "She was always walking on eggshells and trying to toe the line," end quote. And that was with regards to Hannah and how she felt about Rowan. She was just afraid of him, and she couldn't say anything. She just felt it was better to just not say anything at all to him because she couldn't win an argument with him. He was controlling, obviously, severely controlling. He was an abuser. He never was wrong in his eyes. And she feared for her life all the time. And she kept worrying that he was going to take those kids from her. And she did everything in her power to just protect those babies and herself. At one point, she did ask her mom about, I guess, a will, what it would, you know, take for her to get a will, because she was worried about what would happen to the kids or what would happen basically with anything of hers, anything that she had, she knew in her heart that he was going to kill her. And she said, quote, "When he kills me, he'll be in jail, and what happens to the children?" End quote. That's what she asked her mother. And then she also told one of her friends, Lynn Kershaw, numerous times, quote, "I know in my heart he's going to kill me," end quote. This case has kind of brought to light even further how Australia handles domestic violence cases. And not just Australia, obviously. I mean, every country has their own ways for dealing with domestic violence. The United States is no better. Plenty of this happens all over the world where, you know, someone fears for their life and their children's lives, and they try to get away from the abuser, and not enough is done for their abuser to not reach them. And their abuser eventually gets them. And tragically, it ends in something like this case, you know, where they die, them and their children die. The abuser kills themselves as well. They just feel that, I guess, if no one else, you know, if they can't have this person, then no one else is going to have them. So to make themselves happy, they just kill this person, because then they don't have to worry about them anymore. They feel they don't have to worry about them getting with anyone else or moving on and being happy, because you can't move on and be happy if I can't move on and be happy. And that's how a lot of them feel and think. Mrs. Clark also detailed in the inquest about how he treated her. He treated her terribly. As we know, he really disliked her. She talked about the time he had dropped her during the workout and everything of that nature. And she said that he just lacked empathy with everyone. And I had mentioned that earlier, that it wasn't only Hannah that he tried to control. He tried to control everyone around him. He seems to be a very narcissistic person. He had to have control. He had to be the best at everything. I mean, he even got mad when Hannah was outperforming him during working out, you know, which is wild to me, because that's your spouse. You want them to succeed. You want to see them do good in a normal, healthy relationship. And it's sad that a lot of people out there don't have normal, healthy relationships, and then they never get to experience them because things like this happen. But this is a long podcast. I do apologize. I'm rambling. I will cut it off here. But there was a lot of information to go through on this case regarding the inquest and regarding all of the articles written about it. So that concludes this episode. I hope you enjoyed, and please like and subscribe on preferably Spotify, but whatever platform you get your podcast is totally fine. Thank you for listening, and until next time.